Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine, to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I want to welcome back great guest co-host, Dr. Laura Higginbotham. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks, Adam.
We get to talk with the president of the Milbank Memorial Fund, Christopher Keller, about the importance of investing in primary care. You probably believe this.
Absolutely. I think this is something we both have in common, really believing that our healthcare system should start investing money up front to keep our patients healthy before they are diagnosed with disease.
Yeah, that's certainly the mantra of family medicine, primary care, a lot of medical education training today, and we'll talk about that. But first, we've got some research that matters, and let's dive right in. Our very first research is about depression, and do the regular types of antidepressant medications work among depressed patients who have chronic diseases like kidney disease? What's this research about?
Yeah, so this is a great study that was recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA. This is one of our most important journals. And, you know, we know that patients with chronic disease tend to have higher rates of depression. And so this study is important because it shows that patients with kidney disease don't really respond to the typical treatments we prescribe to them. And this is important so that clinicians aren't sort of wasting time or delaying time to getting patients treatment for depression.
Yeah, you know, I really would want to kind of see more about this study, and we're certainly going to need to kind of pull it and go into more detail, because in some respects, it flies in the face of really kind of lots of guidelines that say that antidepressants tend to work, and most of them don't work better than each other. They tend to have some side effects, and so they work well. And then we also know that giving people good supportive therapy, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectic behavioral therapy, psychotherapy, they all seem to work too.
Yeah, and you know, one of the interesting things that the author of this article is working on is actually blood tests to be able to identify patients who may not respond to treatment. Again, with this idea of before even putting them on treatment, can we figure out who may respond the best and who may not so that we can get people the appropriate depression treatment right up front?
Yeah, I've seen that. Actually, some of my patients have come in and they've brought like this whole, you know, 5-10 page handout that says which medicines they respond to and don't. And I'm not certain fully what to think about it. We might ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to maybe look into this. And I think it'd be an interesting segment to find out more about this testing. You know, is it reliable? Is it the standard of care? Do the insurance companies pay for it? Lots of questions I'd have. But I guess one of the questions is, if they're saying that some of these medicines don't work so well with people with a chronic disease, what would we recommend?
Well, so there are a couple of alternative therapies. So there's always psychotherapy or, you know, speaking with a psychologist or a psychiatrist. Other things that are recommended might be exercise or potentially alternative medications besides kind of the standard SSRIs that we use in depression.
Yeah, those medicines like Prozac, which a lot of people use. And it doesn't say that these medicines don't work for most people or a lot of people. It just says that we have to probably individualize treatment, which is probably what we would do to start with and find out in an individual case, is our patient getting better with the treatment? Because for some people, it's inexpensive. It might be very, very helpful for them as part of a treatment, but medicine alone, maybe not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, talking about medicines. This is actually a new antibiotic. And I love the name. I know I'm not quite sure if it's called Teixobactin. I call it Teixobactin because I just think it's got to be developed in Texan because, you know, it's a antibiotic that really deals with resistance. It sounds like it'd be a new, very rugged antibiotic. That's how I think Teixobactin would be. Am I just making that up?
Well, I think you're making up the Texas part because this study
okay.
actually came out of the UK. But that being said, you're right. This does sound like this is a pretty rugged antibiotic that at least in experiments in the laboratory, has been shown to be able to kill these aggressive superbugs like MRSA.
Methicillin-resistant staph aureus, which is really a major killer of people around the world. And I think we see it every single week in the hospital and the outpatient clinics. It's a problem because we don't have a lot of really good drugs to treat it. And then if it gets resistant to the ones that we're using, this could be an alternative.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's the big deal here?
So the big deal here is, you know, we've been on this search for years to be able to find kind of the next antibiotic to treat these drug-resistant bacteria. And this Teixobactin has been in development for a few years now. The issue in the past was that we weren't able to produce it on a sort of a mass scale. So it took about 30 hours to produce one dose. But now these researchers out of the UK have been able to produce it in about 10 minutes. And so hopefully in the next few years, we'll start to see this being produced and moved into clinical trials to test whether in humans it actually can treat these bacteria.
Yeah, they were able to produce more naturally endoracididine. That's a great Scrabble word, but it's kind of like a breakthrough. That's why we're presenting it, because we think that people should hear about this because it's likely to be on the horizon and maybe good. We have to see what the side effects of this particular drug is. Every time we create something to kill more bugs, we sometimes see side effects too.
Yeah, we do. And so, you know, very exciting news coming out of the laboratory and how it actually works in humans, we'll have to see once it reaches the clinical trial stage.
Let's go from the laboratory right to the bench in the after school program. I take it you were a kid once.
I was a kid once.
Yes, me too. Yeah. And my parents like worked and they had to put me in after school. And I don't know if they like all parents, you don't say, oh, I want to be at a good after-school program. But I guess the real question is, what makes a good after-school program? This is some research that may answer that question.
Yeah. So this is a great study that came out of New York University. And this was looking at five after-school programs in New York City for kids in third through eighth grade. And they looked at these five schools, rated them on how positive the relationships were between the children and the caregivers in those after-school programs, how engaged were the students in the programs, and then how sort of chaotic versus organized were the programs. And they found that those with a more positive school environment, more organized, and more student engagement really led to improved outcomes in the children. At 1 year, the children had improved academic skills and also improved confidence in their academic abilities.
Yeah, and this was significant because a lot of these kids were at risk, maybe had low reading skills, other sorts of things that could really improve with this after-school program. And I think this is really very cool because I could see us having little scales now and ratings, just like physicians get rated on quality. These after-schools could get rated on the types of qualities of to the degree which they give positive information, to the degree to which they're engaging, and the degree to which they're organized, because you could have two out of three but be totally chaotic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this serves as a really nice benchmark for after-school programs to start to think about what are the kind of changes they need to make to really offer a positive learning environment for their children.
Well, let's go to our last research that matters about benchmarks. And this is a benchmark on menus. This is about calorie counts on menus. And do they help people make better choices? I think that's a great question.
Yeah, a really fantastic question. And I know something that you and I care a lot about. We see patients at UNC's weight management program in family medicine. And this idea of looking into calories is something that we really ask our patients to do. The thing that's really interesting about this study is this is a meta-analysis. And so this is one of the most powerful research tools that we have, where we can take results from multiple studies and combine them to really see what is the impact on a larger real-world scale. So this meta-analysis looked at 227 studies, and they found that when calories were posted on restaurant menus, people sort of unconsciously decrease the amount of calories that they were having.
Yeah, or even consciously, they may have, I mean, it's, you know, they may have been picking foods that have the lower calories. In addition to which, I guess the retailers were more likely to put these sorts of things on the menu. And so it was kind of a win-win. They were putting things there that people were choosing, and the more they put them, the more people choose. And while it wasn't a lot of calories necessarily overall, like 27 calories per meal, it did find that for certain subgroups like women, it was 60 calories. Those who were overweight, it was 83 calories. So what it suggests that is if you had two or three meals, some people do it a day, a week, you could lose weight simply by ordering better. I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're someone who is eating three meals out a day and you are eating 60 calories less per meal, I mean, that's 180 calories, almost 200 calories right there. So I think this is a fantastic way to not only get our consumers thinking about it, but the people who are producing the food as well.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. And when we return, Laura and I will be talking with Christopher Kohler, the president of the Milbank Memorial Fund, about the importance of investing in primary care. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Laura Higginbotham. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number two ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. Today on Conversations, Laura, we're talking with President of the Milbank Memorial Fund, Christopher Kohler, about the importance of investing in primary care.
Welcome, Mr. Kohler.
It's great to be with you.
You know, it's great to have you. It's a rare time in which we feel like we're talking to a brother or sister across the aisle who really does know and breathe and believe in primary care. We want to know, to start off, a little bit about you. How did you get interested in research, in health policy, in helping set agenda for the American people?
Well, that's quite a significant aspiration you've set out for me. I've never quite defined it that way. But I started out actually in healthcare management. After graduate school, I worked for Staff Model HMO, if your listeners are familiar, say, with Kaiser Permanente. This is an organization that was both an insurance company and employed doctors back when HMOs were not an epithet, but a profession where we actually were trying to combine the delivery and the finances and deal with the reality of finances being finite and there being other uses for it. From there, I moved into Medicaid managed care and ran a Medicaid managed care organization started by community health centers in Rhode Island and then served as health insurance commissioner in the state before taking this job. So I'd say the primary care bug kind of goes back to working in staff model HMOs and understanding that an ounce of prevention is really worth a pound of cure and seeing how you could actually make that work, particularly in a system that wasn't either market-driven or government-run, but this kind of odd hybrid that we have in the U.S. So you have all this data and information about the importance of primary care, and practice doesn't always follow it. So that challenge, both in management and policy, has always really interested me. So that's how I kind of came to it.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And as Adam mentioned, we certainly are believers in primary care. I wonder if you could give our listeners a sense of where we are currently in the United States regarding primary care. Are we using it appropriately, or how are we not using it appropriately? How should we be incorporating this into our healthcare system?
Well, I think primary care has, as a movement or as a service, has two great assets going for it. One is there's an awful lot of evidence about how important it is, that it is the only medical service we have, where the more of it we have, the better the health of our population becomes and the lower our costs get. There is significant research out there that dictates that unlike other medical services, the more primary care we have, the better off we are from a collective sense. And the second asset that primary care has going for it is enormous political appeal. Everybody loves their primary care doc. Everybody loves their pediatrician, whoever takes care of their kids. And so it's always been fascinating to me that in spite of that, the U.S. spends relatively less on primary care than other societies. And we compensate our primary care physicians, not lower, but the gap between specialists and primary care docs is greater here than it is anyplace else. So again, the practice in the U.S. doesn't follow the evidence. And I think that's part of what brings us together, I guess, as comrades in arms on this work.
You know, I was talking with one of my colleagues who I went through fellowship with a number of years ago, who started out at Kaiser and, you know, one of the great HMOs. And yet it seemed at that time that HMOs got a bad name somehow, that they were about rationing care, not about fewer hospitalizations, lower cost, higher patient satisfaction. Have things corrected, or how did they get a bad name?
Oh, they got a bad name because part of the bargain for reducing hospitalizations and trying to reduce costs was to limit choice of procedures and limit, in some cases, choice of doctors. And particularly when patients were paying the bill, when their employers were paying the bill, they didn't understand that trade-off that is essential to a lot of any kind of care coordination or attention to the costs of care. So I think that particularly in the 90s, when managed care really got a bad rap, it was because the economy was strong and employees were complaining to their employers about the limited choice that was coming. And employers said, fine, you have all the choice you want and we'll pay more for it, because they needed to keep employees happy. So it's the fact that we don't pay for the cost of our care. If you think about health insurance versus auto insurance, that's a comparison I like to make. But we're not happy with the government doing it either. And so as a result, we ask the insurance companies to do that work, but we don't like the deal that they come up with.
You know, I wonder, so now we're sort of in the era where healthcare systems are starting to form ACOs or accountable care organizations or MCOs, managed care organizations. And do you foresee that some of those same sort of pits, I guess, that HMOs ran into may be an issue down the road for ACOs or MCOs?
Sure, because I think any time you're limiting care options, the question is going to be asked, who's making the decision? Is it the patient? Is it the physician? Is it some sort of third party? What may be different now is that certainly people who buy their health insurance on the exchange associated with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, they understand these trade-offs. They are good shoppers. They understand that they can pay now or pay later, and they can pay less if they have less choice. But for people who – and I think Medicare folks actually get that with Medicare Advantage. But for people who don't pay it themselves, they're not used to these sorts of trade-offs.
You know, we're going to get into it after the break, really what you call the primary care spending rate. But before we do that, maybe tell us about where does the United States kind of rank? You alluded to it earlier, and I remember one of my colleagues said, well, we're somewhere just above or just below Costa Rica. Not like that was a bad thing, because I love Costa Rica, but it somehow let us know that we were not in the top 25, which is something that probably people would find surprising.
Well, there's a graph that gets a lot of play. I use it with my students, where the vertical axis is lifespan and the horizontal axis is costs. And all the countries are mapped on it. And you'd think that there would be this upward marching line. The more we spend on healthcare, the longer we live, healthcare broadly defined. And to a large part, that line sort of holds. A huge outlier is the U.S., where we are way down in the lower right-hand corner. We spend a lot, but we don't get a whole lot for the money that we spend. I think some of the surveys that you're talking about come from the World Health Organization, which ranks countries' healthcare systems, and that's where we get the sort of we're number 34 or somewhere around Slovenia. I think we're actually quite a bit lower than Costa Rica in terms of cost effectiveness. Another set of rankings come from the Commonwealth Fund, and they looked at developed countries. A much smaller ranking. And whether you look at cost, lifespan, or citizen satisfaction, we consistently do poorer than our equally economically developed countries.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue talking with the president of the Milbank Memorial Fund, Chris Kohler, about the importance of investing in primary care and hear about some of the models that he has championed in Rhode Island and across the United States to really think about primary care spending rates. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with the president of the Milbank Memorial Fund, Christopher Kohler, about the importance of investing in primary care. Chris, you recently wrote a New England Journal piece, and in that you suggested that we should be using the rate of spending in primary care as a way to assess a healthcare system overall. Explain a little bit about what you meant by that.
Well, if you've ever had to put together a budget, Laura, for an organization or for your own family, you know that the budget reflects your priorities. You got to spend so much on housing and so much on food. And it seems to me and to a number of other researchers as well as policy folks like myself, that we can do the same thing with the U.S. healthcare budget. And I got into this because I'm actually running a health plan. I was fascinated by how little we spent on primary care, but how much we talked about it. And when I regularly talk, particularly to folks who are not inside healthcare, the first question I ask is, how much money do you think we spend in the country on primary care? Or what portion of our budget goes to primary care? The answer, if you look at the article, is probably around 6 or 7%, depending on how you spend it. But the responses I get consistently overestimated. They would regularly estimate 10 or 20%. And these non-healthcare folks were shocked to find that what they considered to be so important, basic primary care, access to their pediatrician, to their family practice doc, to their internal medicine doc, garner such a low portion of it, and that these other parts of our healthcare budget consume relatively a lot more. And once you can educate people on that, then you can start to say, well, you know, how do we spend more on primary care? Can we start to measure this on a regular basis and see what happens if we do spend more money on it? And so that's really been, I think, the focus of efforts in Rhode Island, in Oregon, and really was the genesis of this article as well.
Tell us about your leadership in Rhode Island. What did y'all find? I read about this and I was like, how come I haven't heard about this? This is amazing.
Well, how many states in the country have a health insurance commissioner?
At least one.
The answer is one in Rhode Island. So your typical insurance commissioner is responsible for a whole bunch of lines of business, property and casualty, personal and things like that. In Rhode Island, for various reasons, they actually created a cabinet level post to focus just on healthcare because they recognize that healthcare is different. You know, if you can't afford to pay the insurance on your car, you walk or you take a bus. But we don't compel mechanics to treat your car. But for healthcare, if you can't afford health insurance, we still compel the emergency room and the hospitals to take care of you. So Rhode Island recognized that we really look at healthcare in a different way. And they wanted someone to really look at how insurers were behaving and how to hold them accountable for the very important issue of staying solvent and making sure they deliver benefits to consumers, but also making sure the insurers are spending their money in ways that help improve the system. And so when we got together an advisory group that we had to have under law to say, what should we hold the health insurers accountable for? And this is a group of small business people, you know, just sort of everyday folks. They got that a lot of our healthcare expenses are things that insurers can't control, that insurers, they can't alone help people improve their chronic conditions or stop smoking or lose weight or something like that. But they were really impressed by the primary care data. And they said, you know, if we pay more to primary care and a little bit less to some other medical services, chances are that we would save money and improve our health over the long term. And so it wasn't really me. It was the advisory group that said, you know what? 6% is too low. We think our insurers should be more around 10 or 11% for primary care. And so over a period of about 5 or 6 years, the insurers did that. We held them accountable for increasing the portion of their budget that went to primary care. And there are a lot of people who predicted doomsdays, you know, that we would lose specialists, that everything would come tumbling down. And that wasn't the case. There are also people who said, you know, it'll be peace, love, and harmony. And that's not the case either. Rhode Island has lower cost trends than it did before, but it's still got lots of challenges to work on. But they're in a better place because they have a big, strong commitment to primary care.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful and very powerful story. You mentioned in that same New England Journal piece that actually in Rhode Island, the primary care spending increased from $47 million to, I believe, around $74 million. And I'm wondering, what was that money going towards? What was it sort of earmarked for?
So here's where the advisory group was. They were pretty thoughtful. They said, insurers, we don't want you just to give primary care docs more money. Don't just increase their rates, because we understand that fee-for-service payments just kind of encourage doctors to do more. So they said, we want it to go to primary care practices in what now we would call alternate payment mechanisms, some other ways other than fee-for-service. We want it to go for health information technology. We want it to go for care coordination, for additional nurses and things like that. And we tried to encourage creativity. So we gave broad guidance to the health plans, but we didn't get overly specific with it because we wanted to see what the health plans would come up with. And one health plan did a whole lot of incentives on the back end, pay for performance and things like that. And another one paid for a whole lot of what we call infrastructure, nurses and care management and things like that. So we had kind of some natural experiments that were going on.
You know, you started out talking about how primary care has political appeal. And I might even say, it sounds like through your work, you're trying to make it politically sexy. And how do we market that? How does the work, and is that part of what you or the foundation does of trying to move that concept from the kind of the fringe to the center of the discussions for healthcare reform?
Well, I start with the fact that 50 to 60% of the dollars in healthcare in the U.S. today is spent by the government. And it's been slowly creeping up, but that's not going to change so long as we have a Medicare program that enjoys broad political support and more people finding they can't afford their healthcare and they are looking to Medicaid to help with it. So I think our target is policymakers. We don't think that consumer spending, a consumer revolution, is going to increase the value of primary care. We think that if Medicare pays more for primary care relative to specialists, we think that Medicaid can do that. And we also think it's insurers recognize, this is the thing that we learned in Rhode Island, insurers recognize the value of primary care. They're looking for someone to give them permission to do the right thing. So when you say to insurers you have to spend more on primary care, they're only happy to point to somebody else to tell other physicians with more market power why they can't get as much money as they might hope they to in rate increases. And then I think the last thing I'd say is the primary care spend is a way to educate folks. It's a way to sort of call attention to this important part of our healthcare sector. It doesn't get as much investment as it gets in high-performing health systems, systems that have lower costs, better health, and higher consumer satisfaction, spend more money on primary care. And pointing to this primary care spend as a budget is a good way to do it.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great answer, maybe about from your mouth to God's ears.
Chris, as we close our conversation today, any final thoughts that you want to leave with our listeners?
Well, I think that listeners, people, we are much more fluent in healthcare than we were a few years ago because of the debate around the Affordable Care Act. And the thing about what I found about primary care is, as Adam was saying, it really is bipartisan. It enjoys support. And it's a great way to start a conversation, I think, around healthcare in a way that people can agree with. We might not agree on what are the right levels of insurance and how insurance can be organized, but there's broad support for primary care. And I think just whether you're talking to colleagues or if they're talking to policymakers, you know, letting it be known that they understand that a good, high-performing healthcare system has to be built on a strong base of primary care. It's we can all engage in that because we're all going to need it. You know, that's our point of entry into healthcare. And I think when we get sick, we want to make sure that we have someone there who we can work with to help treat us in our illnesses. And that's what primary care is about.
I know, Laura, and I want that for ourselves, too.
Absolutely.
Listen, we really need to thank you, Chris Kohler, president of the Milbank Memorial Fund, for the work that you and the fund is doing, the article that you had in the New England Journal of Medicine, which we will link to, and appreciate the time and passion you're bringing to make a difference.
Well, great. Thanks for your interest in the project and also for the work that you do on this program with educating your listeners.
We're going to take a short break. But coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Laura Higginbotham. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Laura and I are going to talk about your health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can just send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I have to have surgery next week on my arm, and the doctor said they were going to do a nerve block instead of general anesthesia. Can you tell me a little bit about what to expect?
Yeah, hopefully not much pain.
Exactly.
Well, Laura, you've done a lot of surgery. I'm sure that you use nerve blocks.
Yeah, we do. So, you know, a nerve block is when your anesthesiologist or surgeon will inject some local numbing medication to the spot of the surgery to basically block any sort of pain receptors from transmitting that information up the nerve into the brain. So the whole point of it is to be able to block that pain from traveling, so you shouldn't perceive pain at all. Now, how that differs from general anesthesia is that you will be awake for this.
Which could be a little scary, a little frightening.
Yeah, could be, certainly. A lot of times, your anesthesiologist might give you a little something to help you relax, but you will still be awake. Often, too, they will probably block you from being able to see the arm so that visually you can't see what's happening during the surgery.
You can't take a mirror.
You could if you wanted to, but
why would you want to?
Well, you'd be laying down. You know, I once had a nerve block, and I remember it was funny because I, like halfway through, I was like, stop. Everyone looks up and goes, I said, you're operating on the wrong person. I don't feel a thing, you know. But it's like being able to engage and laugh, I think, at times, particularly when you're scared. I think laughter would go a long way. I don't know most people would laugh. Probably if they're a doctor, they might. But
yeah, I'm not sure most patients would. But hopefully you trust your surgeon and you trust your anesthesiologist. And, you know, nerve blocks are something that are done all the time. So very safe.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a fitness instructor, and occasionally I'll get floor burns while teaching a class. Usually they go away on their own fairly easily, but recently one didn't, and my doctor told me this week that it's MRSA. How worried should I be?
Well, moderately, I would say. A little bit.
Yeah.
More than nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why would we say a little bit rather than a lot or nothing?
So MRSA stands for methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So it's a... Staph aureus is a common bacteria that causes a lot of infections, but when we talk about it being MRSA or methicillin resistant, it means that it doesn't respond to the typical antibiotics that we would use to treat this bacteria. And so while there are antibiotics that can treat it, we say moderately concerned because it is a little more difficult than were it just normal staph.
And you have had it now, so you may well get it again. Your skin may become what we call colonized with it. It lives on your skin, and so you may not have to get an injury to have it in the future. But I would say talk with your doctor. They may talk with you about using some antibacterial soap when you wash in the shower rather than just maybe a milder soap if you need that. And you might need antibiotics, but hopefully that's not too much or too bad. Hopefully you will not need that antibiotic that we talked about at the beginning of the show, that – what do we say? Texobactin?
Texobactin.
When yeah. I call Texo, you say TXO. Yeah, you won't need that. Hope you do really well. Thank you so much for that question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 24-year-old son has severe autism, and he sometimes screams and sometimes looks even like he's in pain, but it's not easy to figure out when I need to take him to the doctor. What do you recommend?
Boy, that's a really difficult question. I care for a fair number of children, adult children, younger children, adults who've had autism spectrum disorder, who've had autism, who've got developmental problems, and it's not easy. But what I rely on a lot of times is what the caretaker tells me.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I mean, you know your son more than anyone else. And so I would say, you know, if this seems like his typical way of trying to communicate, then it's probably okay. But if things start to seem out of how he normally responds and interacts with you, then maybe that's a time you would want to visit your physician.
You know, it's never a problem to bring the patient in to be checked. What I will say is it's helpful if you bring them into someone who knows, given our previous conversation with Chris Kohler, the importance of primary care, to bring them into someone who's seen your child before so that, that we can understand. Because if I've never seen your child, I may not know what's normal for you and whether or not he calms down when he sees me versus – or sometimes way too quiet. Normally lots of active and then all of a sudden real quiet, that could also be a problem too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as you're sort of hinting at, the biggest thing to look for would be changes from kind of the normal way that he behaves and interacts with different people.
I mean, if eating starts to change, if the temperature starts to change, things that are really, you know, more, I would say, objective signs. But I take it for serious. If you say something's different, I should look into it. Thank you so much for that question and good luck. Laura, what's our very last house call?
My mother is 93 and in great health. She's on no medications and maybe a little hard of hearing, but who isn't? Does she really need to come in every year to see her doctor for a physical?
Can you repeat that question, Laura? Oh, boy, that's something that I'd love to be able to hear and to say to lots of patients at that age. And to have that question being asked.
Yeah, agreed. You know, this is a really tough one. And I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer necessarily. I mean, I think this really depends on your mom and what her goals are. You know, it sounds like she's early 90s and still really healthy. And so I would say probably a good idea to still come in for her annual physicals if there are kind of things that might be easily treatable, like a little cold that we could prevent from becoming pneumonia, for example. But whether she needs more sort of aggressive measures like screening, colonoscopies, or those types of things, probably not if they're not going to impact her longevity. But again, no right or wrong answer. And I think it really depends on a discussion with her and what her goals are.
A flu shot would be good.
Flu shot would be great. Yeah. Can't believe I forgot that.
Oh, no. You see, that's for my mother, when she's like, you know, she would say, I'd have to go and get my flu shot. I said, Mom, it's only March. Got to wait till October. But I do think that sometimes I tell patients like this, Laura, that, you know, you don't need the care, but I need the care. It'd be really great. I really would miss not seeing you. Would you just come in for me?
Hmm.
And sometimes they're, you know, because it is sometimes a really good relationship, and we can find out if there's some concerns that have come up in the interim. So I think it's a good idea. On the other hand, you know, if you were 110 and maybe got there, you know, I don't know. I do think finally that we should say, you know, the life expectancy when you're 93 is another 5 or 6 years. So it's not like, you know, something's imminent real soon. So it gives us a chance to talk about things like advanced directives and living wills and things we may or may not have done.
Yeah, that's a great point. Any opportunity that you can have to sort of put together an advance directive and really talk about what your wishes are so that your family and your medical providers are aware, it's a great opportunity to make sure that that happens.
Maybe we should just ask the mother what she wants.
Yeah.
Radical concept. Well, that'll conclude Your Health Today. We want to thank all of our listeners and hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and search for our health app, one word, Your Health, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my great guest co-host, Dr. Laura Higginbotham, and our guest today, Christopher Kohler. We hope to join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Laura Higginbotham.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.